Welcome back to Question Medicine. 2019 is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It is time to get into some more of the literature. I am still catching up with previous articles that I've previously read that are probably a month and a half, 2 months old at this time. I'm probably always going to be catching up because I'm just reading more articles than I'm podcasting about. But that is the nature of the beast. So without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Let's kick it off with an article that you probably have heard here first, or at least a idea or a concept that you've certainly heard here first on Questioning Medicine. It was in BMJ 2018 in a paper titled Detecting Cervical Precancer and Reaching Unscreened Women by Using HPV Testing on Self-Samples. So let's break this down. We now have high-level evidence that screening for high-risk HPV testing is more effective than screening by cytology for protecting against future cervical precancer and cancer. And there's a whole Right on Prime piece coming where Joe and I are really going to break down the numbers. So I don't want to get too nitty gritty about it because you should go over there and listen to that. However, high risk HPV testing provides another advantage in that it can be done on vaginal samples collected by the patient. Oh yes, the self swab. And this is huge. And don't forget that if we're talking about screening for STDs, the self swab is actually better. It's better than clinician swabbing. Now, this paper that we're referring to kills two birds with one stone because this was an update to two meta-analyses. One was on the accuracy of self-sample tested for high-risk HPV to detect cancer or precancer of the cervix, and one was an update on the potential strategies to reach women who were not screened. So let's look at the accuracy of high-risk HPV screening. The pooled absolute sensitivity of HPV screening assay for CIN2+ based on PCR technology was 96% for both the self-samples and clinician samples. It is important that you're using PCR technology and not signal amplification, as signal amplification is not nearly as sensitive. This is awesome. 96% sensitive. Remember, this is a screening test, so we want high sensitivity. So now that we have that, let's see what happens when they updated the meta-analysis for those in participation. What happened to the participation medals? Well, the relative participation was 87 to 133 times more likely or higher in the self-sampling arm versus the control arm in trials that use mail-to scenario, meaning I'm going to mail you this sample. We're looking at 100 times more likely to have participation. Overall, because you had more women at home participating in screening, and the test that you're using, the swab, the high-risk HPV, is the exact same sensitivity, whether you test it on a bazillion people or 50,000 people. And since you're having this many exponentially more people doing the screening test, as you can imagine, there was higher rates of detection in those that were in the male arm, meaning higher rates of for those that actually participated in screening, which is what we want. We want people to participate in screening. That's the whole point of cervical cancer and colon cancer, all these screenings, is to screen everyone so we can actually catch cancer prior to it happening. And speaking of things that we would like to have happen prior, well, that's a poor intro. Anyways, what I'm trying to say is we would like for you to not be obese. However, if you are overweight or obese, there is a bazillion diets out there. And one of the newest fads out there is intermittent fasting. There was an article out on intermittent fasting, and I think it deserves some attention. It was titled Effects of Intermittent versus Continuous Energy Intakes on Insulin Sensitivity and Metabolic Risk in Women with Overweight. This was in the Journal of Obesity in December. Now let's talk about this intermittent fasting because it seems to be the rage these days. And there's something special about intermittent fasting that I don't think has been shown with any other diet yet, or at least not that I'm aware of. You see, in this study, they looked at 88 women with a BMI average of about 32, and then they were randomized to one of four diets. You were either on intermittent fasting 70, intermittent fasting 100, dietary restriction 70, or the control. Now, as you can imagine, intermittent fasting 70, you were at 70% of calculated baseline energy requirements per week. Intermittent fasting 100, you were at 100% of the calculated baseline energy requirements per week, but you were doing intermittent fasting, meaning that you had to agree that on three non-consecutive days a week, you would fast for 24 hours. So Monday, you fast for 24 hours, you can eat on Tuesday. Wednesday, 24 hours fast, eat on Thursday. Friday, you fast, and you can eat Saturday and Sunday. Now again, you're fasting for this whole time, but or for those 3 days, but in intermittent fasting 100, you're still getting 100% of your calculated baseline energy requirements. The other two factors were continuous restriction 70, so that those individuals were just continually restricted to 70% of their calculated baseline energy requirements, and then you had the control, which was 100%. They were allowed to eat 100% of the calculated baseline energy. And the thing that made this great was that all foods in this diet were provided by the study, meaning it didn't, you couldn't say, well, I ate this and I ate this, and you could, I guess, but they gave you the food to eat. They gave you the meals at your door. So it was a lot harder to cheat when you didn't have to guess what the person was actually eating. You knew what they were eating because you provided the meals for them. And I could get into the blood markers that happened where they were looking at the CRP and the SED rates and how the hyperlipidemia and the cholesterol. But here's the bottom line. If you go on a diet, you go on a diet to lose weight, period. End of story. You go on a diet to lose weight. In fact, I don't know of anyone ever has ever went to the doctor and says, listen, I want to go on a diet to get my SED rate a little better. I want to go on a diet to get my LDL a little better. Ultimately, you go on a diet to lose weight. So let's, in this study, look at the weight loss. In the intermittent fasting 70, they beat the intermittent fasting 100 by about 2.7 kilograms. Not bad. You might not bad. That's about 6 pounds. And I know you might say, well, that makes sense because they're getting 70% less. I mean, 30% less calories, which is 70% minus 100%. So 30% less calories. It makes sense that they're going to lose weight. However, the intermittent fasting 70 also beat the continuous 70 by 1.5 kilograms. Again, we're looking at 3.5 pounds. And those technically were the same calorie intakes, right? 70% of your daily required intake and the intermittent fasting one. And if that didn't say something to you, well, the intermittent fasting 100 lost more weight and fat than the control group. And remember, the control group was also at 100% of their total intake. So both of them are having 100% of their total intake, yet the intermittent fasting lost 2.7 kilograms, while the control group lost only 0.4 kilograms. Again, here we're looking at a difference of about 5 pounds. Now, in case you're wondering, they also looked at insulin sensitivity, weight, body composition, and plasma markers, and the intermittent fasting 70 had greater reductions in weight, fat mass, total, and low density LDLs and hyperlipidemia, HDLs, and the non-fatty acids. But it really is the weight. It's the weight that people want. And it just appears that intermittent fasting does something that we cannot describe. And remember, this whole trial took course over 8 weeks. People were losing 5 pounds more over 8 weeks. That's, you know, basically 1 pound or just under 1 pound a week by doing intermittent fasting versus the same exact caloric intake with continuous fasting. There is something magical about intermittent fasting that we probably don't completely understand at this point, but it does seem to work, and I have not seen this with other diet plans. Now that we've talked about something that works, or at least seems to work, let's talk about something that doesn't work. Vitamin D. Vitamin D, I don't think works. We've had every single trial to the moon and back on vitamin D. It doesn't appear to work. In the most recent trial, December 11th, 2018, in a paper in JAMA titled Effect of Oral Alpha-Calcidol on clinical outcomes in patients without secondary hyperparathyroidism receiving maintenance hemodialysis. The question here that they're trying to answer was, does treatment with the active form of vitamin D reduce cardiovascular risk in patients that are undergoing hemodialysis? Now, this makes sense that we should study this because, well, first of all, vitamin D doesn't work. But if it was going to work, if it has any cardiovascular protective properties, well, then it's probably on those that are on dialysis. Because we know that individuals on dialysis are already at serious risk for cardiovascular events. They're at such serious risk that per a paper in May titled Hemodialysis-Induced Cardiovascular Disease, they say, and I quote, "More than half of all deaths among end-stage renal disease patients are due to cardiovascular disease. Greater than 50% of deaths in those on dialysis is due to cardiovascular disease." And there are a lot of questions or reasoning as to why this is, but it is believed that patients with chronic kidney disease have impaired vitamin D activation and elevated cardiovascular risk. Observational studies in patients treated with hemodialysis have showed that the use with active vitamin D has been associated with lower risk of all-cause mortality regardless of the parathyroid hormone level. But as is noted that I watched and I observed the Dallas Cowboys win against the Seattle Seahawks wearing my lucky underwear, that clearly did not mean that they were going to beat the Rams in the second round of the playoffs. So we have to have a randomized trial. And here we go. In this randomized, open-label, blinded, endpoint, multi-center study of just over 1,200 patients at 207 dialysis centers in Japan, they were treated with either 0.5 nanograms of oral alpha-calcitriol, that is so hard to pronounce, the active form of vitamin D, or they were treated without vitamin D receptor activator. So this should be awesome. This should be the study that we're looking for. And the primary outcome was the composite measure of fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular events, including myocardial infarctions, hospitalization for congestive heart failure, stroke, aortic dissection, aortic rupture, amputation of lower limb due to ischemia, and cardiac sudden death, coronary revascularization, and leg artery revascularization during 48 months of follow-up. That is a huge cluster mess. You have to find something. Anytime that you have a composite outcome that big, you have to be able to find something if it's there. But I'll let you take a wild guess at what they found. Well, of course, they found nothing. And not only did the large composite outcome fail, it also failed when it was broken down individually. Individually, none of those outcomes reached statistical significance. And the interesting thing is that although none of them reached statistical significance, there was a signal for harm of serious adverse events that were classified as cardiovascular events in those individuals that were randomized to vitamin D. It didn't reach statistical significance. It was 40.8% versus 40.1%. But again, that's about the best that we have in this whole study, and it was in the harm. So this we can do away with. Go out in the sun. Don't take vitamin D. Now, I started this podcast out talking about cervical cancer, and it seems like anytime you do a podcast, or life really, everything comes full circle. Everything comes back to the beginning. So what if I told you that there was a vaccine? There was a magical, mystical vaccine out there that could prevent cancer. It could not only prevent cancer, that this vaccine actually prevents cancer in approximately 12,000 women each year, according to the CDC. And that this vaccine, according to the most recent United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines, is all you need to do. It's all you need to screen for in order to detect cervical cancer. And this vaccine, it protects against this virus or this thing that we're looking for. Well, the good news is we do have a vaccine. The vaccine, the HPV vaccine, actually works. And the good news is that not only does it work, but it appears to work in herd immunity, which we know is the key to all vaccines. And that was shown in this paper titled Human Papilloma Virus Vaccine Effectiveness and Herd Protection in Young Women. basically, in the end, as the vaccine rate went up, the rates of HPV went down. In this study, young women aged 13 to 26 years of age were recruited from a Cincinnati hospital-based community health clinic for surveillance studies from 2006 to 2017. Now, as you can imagine, in 2006 to 2007, there were less women being vaccinated because at this point, the vaccine was still relatively new. In 2016 to 2017, the rates of vaccination had went up. Now, as the rates of vaccination have went up from 2006 to 2007, and then 2009 to 2010, and 2013 to 2014, the rates of HPV-positive women have went down. I think that this makes sense overall. If Susie gets the vaccine and then doesn't have HPV, and she has sexual relations with Tony, then she is not giving the HPV vaccine to Tony, who then gives it to Kelly. But if Susie doesn't get the vaccine and she gets the HPV virus, and then Tony gets that HPV virus from Susie, and then he goes and gives it to Kelly, it's a continuous cycle where all we have to do is start giving the vaccine. It's out there. You only need to get two doses of it now, two shots of it now. I think this is, I know this is definitely game time ready, but this is probably the biggest vaccine that we've had since maybe polio. I mean, I don't know of another vaccine in which prevents cancer, and cancer is bad. So we should give the vaccine. But speaking of other things that are bad, a fasting blood sugar that's high is bad. And if it's really high, that also seems to be really, really bad. But just high, maybe not so bad. That is shown in this article in Diabetes Care titled Long-Term Absolute Risk for Cardiovascular Disease Stratified by Fasting Glucose Level. In this study, they used pooled data from seven observational cohorts of U.S. black and white men and women and followed them from 1960 to 2015. That is, what, 55 years of research? They had a total of almost 20,000 individuals without prior cardiovascular events. So this is primary prevention. As the fasting glucose in these individuals went up, what happened to the rate of cardiovascular events was what this study set out to find. Now remember, they had to use the fasting glucose because this study goes back to 1960. We were not using the A1C back in 1960. And as a side note, just in my own little side research here, I found articles from 2010. 2010, only 9 years ago, in which they are still questioning the use of an A1C as the gold standard for the diagnosis of diabetes. That just seems crazy to me. But I digress. So here we go. They used the fasting glucose and they broke you down into different groups as followed. For those in Canada and everywhere else except for America, if you were less than 5 millimoles per liter, you were in one group. If you were 5 to 5.5, 5.6 to 6.2, 6.3 to 6.9, and then if you had diabetes, which was a fasting glucose of greater than or equal to 7 millimoles per liter. For those of us in America, that equals out to a fasting glucose of less than 110, 110 to 118, 120 to 132, 134 to 144, and then greater than 146. And remember, they were looking at what happened to your cardiovascular disease, what happened to cardiovascular events. This was defined as fatal and non-fatal coronary heart disease and fatal and non-fatal stroke. The results were interesting. If you had a fasting glucose of less than 5, 5 to 5.5, and 5.6 to 6.2, which for those of you in America, that equals basically all the ranges from 132 down, there basically was no difference in your rates of cardiovascular events. For women, you were right about 15.5%. For men, you were right about 22%. Shouldn't be a surprise. We know that men have more cardiovascular events than women. But if you had a fasting glucose greater than 7, if you're following along in America, a fasting glucose greater than 146, the event rate jumped up dramatically. For women, the cardiovascular event rate went up to 38%, and for men, it jumped up to 47%, almost 2.5 times what it was, to 2 to 2.5 times what it was for those individuals that were just at 132 and below. Now, remember, 132 fasting glucose, this could still be considered an individual with diabetes. I think this speaks to all diabetes is not all diabetes. An A1C of 6.6 is not the same as an A1C of 9.8. I think we know that intuitively when I say it. However, when the patient comes in, you still think to yourself, oh man, they're still at risk for cardiovascular events and strokes. Well, actually, probably they're not. They're probably about at the same exact risk, according to this research, that someone who has a fasting glucose of 110 or an A1C of even 5.9 is. The numbers are just numbers. They're arbitrary numbers that we make up, but too high seems to be a really bad thing. A little high, not good. We should counsel them because we don't want them to get to really high, because when they get to really high, bad things happen. I think this is shown in about everything in medicine. Too little, probably not good. Too much, definitely not good. Too much of anything is a bad thing. Moderation seems to be the best for all things. And with that being said, moderation is probably the best way to handle this podcast. So, let me wrap it up, and then I'll end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it.
And here we go in 30 seconds or less. Here we go. The self-swab is real. It works. It's better than the physician swab, for at least for STD testing. And self-swabbing works for cancer detection, or at least for the HPV virus detection. And it helps us get to a population that otherwise wouldn't be able to get screened. Next article is that intermittent fasting does something we can't explain. And you happen to lose more weight when you're doing intermittent fasting than you are just calorie restriction. It seems to work. I can't explain it. Vitamin D doesn't work in those individuals without renal disease. And even if you have renal disease and you're on dialysis, it doesn't work, or at least not for cardiovascular events. The HPV vaccine works, and it also works for herd immunity, which is a great thing with any vaccine. Bottom line, get the shot. And last but not least is that if you have diabetes, a fasting glucose level greater than 131 seems to be where the badness happens, where the badness of cardiovascular events occur. So try to keep patients under a fasting glucose of 131, because all diabetes is not diabetes, and it is likely a J-shaped curve to when the bad events actually occur.
And there we go. That is a wrap. So remember, please give me a review on iTunes. Tell your friends to listen in. That's another way that you can help this podcast out. If you have any questions, you can always email me, andrewbilt@gmail.com. I will end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.